Yes, heaven. Come on, Jack. Give me a definition. Oh. How exactly would you describe it?
I'll have to think about that one.
Asked to describe heaven, leading Christian apologist says, sorry, I haven't the foggiest idea. Wouldn't go down too well, would it?
All right. Heaven. Heaven is Oxford.
Ah, sure, I might have guessed. The great Oxford itself.
Wait, I haven't finished.
Well?
Heaven is Oxford, lifted and placed in the middle of County Down.
Oh, well done. Spoken like a true Ulsterman, Jack. Ah, it's good to have you home, even if it's not often enough.
Listen, it may please the world to suppose that I'm as English as Oxford marmalade, but the truth is, I have no patriotic feeling for anything English except Oxford, for which I would live and die. But as to Ulster, I doubt if there is anyone who loves the hills of Down more than I.
Then a toast to Ulster.
Ulster.
Daddy! Hello, Mr. Jack. Daddy, will you read me a story before I go to bed?
Let me see. Well, I really think you'd better ask our guest to read you this one. Jack?
Ah, The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe.
It's my favourite book.
Is it now? Well, as it so happens, it's one of my favourites too.
You've read it?
Better than that, Penny. Mr. Jack wrote it.
It's true, I'm afraid. See, there's my name. C.S. Lewis.
Not Jack?
No, my friends call me Jack, but I always use my proper name on my books.
Why?
I don't know. I suppose I've just always thought that's what you're supposed to do.
So you wrote all these words?
Yes, every single one. I really did. However, I didn't sketch the pictures, as I'm not very good at drawing, but I'll show you a picture that, if I had been an artist, I would have drawn very differently. Here now. See this giant? He really should have a beard.
Ah. Should he?
Almost certainly. Giants almost never shave.
Why?
Well, because they can't get razor blades to the right size.
That's silly.
Is it? All I can say, Penny, is you ask the very next giant you meet and see what he says.
Now run along and get yourself ready for bed. And perhaps Mr. Jack will come up and read to you for a while.
Will you? Please?
I don't see why not. My, what a lot of books.
I love stories.
So do I, Penny. When I was your age, I had almost as many books as you have. And what's more, the house where I read them was not very far from here.
Where is your house?
Well, when I was a boy, I lived in Dundalla Villas in Strandtown Village. Do you know it?
I pass it on my way to school.
Well, there you are then. That's where I was born. Many, many years before you were born. Now, where's that book?
Here. Will I tell you the part I love?
Oh, what's that?
When Lucy goes through the wardrobe.
They looked into a room that was quite empty, except for one big wardrobe, the sort that has a looking glass in the door. There was nothing else in the room at all, except
a dead blue bottle
on the windowsill. Nothing there, said Peter, and they all trooped out again. All except Lucy. She stayed behind because she thought it would be worthwhile trying the door of the wardrobe, even though she felt almost sure that it would be locked. To her surprise, it opened quite easily. She immediately stepped into the wardrobe. And, of course, you know what happened after that.
She went into Narnia.
Indeed she did.
How did you know that Lucy could get to Narnia through the wardrobe?
Ah.
Have you been there?
Maybe. Sometimes I feel as if I've been there.
Do you want me to read to you? Daddy says I'm a good reader.
Oh, yes. That would be lovely.
This must be a simply enormous wardrobe, thought Lucy. Something cold and soft was falling on her. A moment later, she found that she was standing in the middle of a wood at night time, with snow under her feet and snowflakes falling through the air. Lucy felt a little frightened, but she felt very inquisitive and excited as well. She looked back over her shoulder and there...
The wardrobe. What would I find if I climbed into the wardrobe? Narnia? No, no. Not Narnia. Where then? Somewhere safe, secure. The past? My childhood. I can still hear Lizzie's voice.
Master Clive! Master Warren! I will call you wee rascals again. It's time for your bath.
Hide! In the trunk. No, wait. In Grandpa's wardrobe. Come on.
If you two don't get out of those dirty clothes and in this bath, you'll get no supper. You wait till I get my hands on you. If you're happy going to the devil with dirt on your faces, then there's no hope for you.
Shh. Yuck. It's so dusty in here. Stop sitting on me.
Well, get off my foot then.
I can't. I'm right up against the back.
Maybe there's a secret door in the back panel, like in all the adventure stories.
Don't be stupid. She's coming.
Master Clive, Master Warren, are you hiding in here? Very well then. But when certain two young gentlemen finally come for the baths, they'll find my temper short and the water cold.
She's gone. Now let's make up a story.
I'll start. Once upon a time in Ulster... There
was once upon a time in Ulster. Ulster. Mountain and clouds. Gorse and rock. Woods of rowan, birch and small fir. Small fields divided by ditches and ragged, sea-nipped hedges. Small abandoned quarries filled with cold-looking water. Wind whistling through grass that is soft, rich and sweet. Once upon a time in Ulster, there were two brothers, Warren Hamilton, who was 3 years older than the other brother, who was me, and who was named Clive Staples.
Clive Staples, I baptize thee in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Ghost. Amen.
I was christened by my grandfather at his church, St. Mark's, Dundalla. Clive Staples Hamilton. My Christian name. But I had other ideas.
Sit up straight at the table, Clive. Clive, did you hear what I said?
I don't want to be called Clive.
What's the boy talking about?
It's a stuffy name. I don't know any other boys called Clive.
But that's your name.
It's not as bad as Warren.
Warren and Clive are both perfectly good names. Otherwise, your mother and I would not have given them to you.
But I don't want to be called Clive anymore.
Oh? Then who are you going to be?
Jack.
Never heard such nonsense in all my life.
From now on, I'll be Jack.
Jack. Jack Lewis. That's not a very memorable name at all.
He's more like a Jack than a Clive.
Well, at least Warren seems to approve.
He's not Warren. Who am I then? Jack? Warney!
Warney. One of the blessings of my life. He never seemed to be an elder brother.
Warney? I like it.
We were allies, not to say confederates, from the first.
Yes, Mummy and Pappy. From now on, we are Warney and Jack.
Well, Albert, like it or not, it seems we have two new children in the house.
Well, I've often remarked that having two children would bring us to the brink of poverty. Now it seems we have four, which will undoubtedly result in us ending in the workhouse.
There were many blessings in those young years. Good food, good parents. My mother, Florence Augusta Hamilton, was Irish.
Mummy, it's like most middle-aged ladies. Stout, brown hair, spectacles, knitting is her chief industry.
A clergyman's daughter from a long line of knights, bishops, lawyers and naval men. She was herself a scholar with first-class honours from Queen's University.
Becomes the throned monarch better than his crown. His sceptre shows the force of temporal power, the attribute to awe and majesty, wherein doth sit the dread and fear of kings. Now, you carry on, Jack.
What mercy is above this?
Sceptred sway?
It is.
Enthroned?
In the heart of kings, it is. At attribute.
Attribute?
To God himself, an earthly power doth then show.
Likest gods, when mercy seasons justice. Well done, Jack.
The rectory where the Hamilton family lived was not far from where my father's family had their home. They met first, when a young couple, as members of the Sunday morning congregation at my grandfather's church, and after a good deal of wooing on my father's part, they eventually became engaged and were married. My father, Albert James Lewis, was a solicitor.
Pappy, of course, is the master of the house, has strong Lewis features, bad temper, very sensible, nice when he's not in the temper.
Largely self-educated, he was a man of letters, a considerable public speaker, and yet was capable of more misunderstandings and bizarre non-sequiturs than any man I have ever known.
Pappy, there's a boy in the village.
What boy?
Churchwood.
What about this chickweed boy?
Churchwood, Pappy. Well, he caught a big field mouse, and he kept it for a whole year.
He kept a rat for a whole year?
It was a field mouse.
Well, it must have been very large to have been mistaken for a rat.
No, Pappy, not a rat, a field mouse.
My father's grandfather had been a Welsh farmer. His father, a self-made man, had begun life as a workman, emigrated to Ireland, and ended as a partner in the firm of McIlwain and Lewis, boilermakers, engineers, and iron ship builders. Ships. How proud we were to live near Belfast docks. For where the River Laggan flowed into the loch was to be found one of Europe's leading industrial ports. With its forest of cranes, this was the place where our grandfather worked, where they had the largest gantry in the British Isles, and where in January 1899, 6 weeks after my birth, they had launched the largest ship afloat, the Oceanic. The sound of a steamer's horn at night still conjures up my whole boyhood.
You hear that sound, Master Jack?
The steamer?
Steamer? Is that what you really think it is?
Another blessing of our childhood was our nurse, Lizzie Endicott.
What is it, Lizzie?
Well, Master Warney, your brother may like to fancy it's nothing more than a steamer horn, but wiser heads know better.
Do you know? Tell us, Lizzie.
Well, I reckon it's the horn of one of those great giants who lives away, away upon the far hills.
Giants?
Aye, great lumbering brutes.
There aren't really any giants.
Haven't you heard tell of the great Finn MacCool, and how Finn and the Scottish giant Fearrua, the mighty red man as he was known, who was at least a yard taller than Finn, had a hurling match and tossed great boulders the size of a crag or more as far as Cork and beyond. But you too mark Lizzie's words, and you don't go heeding that giant's horn, or it'll spirit you away. Heaven only knows where.
Lizzie, in whom even the exacting memory of childhood can discover no flaw, nothing but kindness, gaiety, and good sense.
I'll give you a piece of advice if you care to remember it, Master Jack.
What?
Simply this, and it's an old, old saying, and none the worse for that. Don't go breaking your shin on a stool that's not in your way.
What does it mean?
Well, if I have to explain, then you'll likely be breaking a shin sooner than you think.
From before I can remember, I had understood that certain jokes could be shared with Lizzie, which were impossible in the drawing room.
Master Jack, will you leave the bathwater alone? Stop all that splashing, do you hear me?
Jack!
That's quite enough. I've a mind to snack your little pink piggy bottom.
No, Lizzie, don't.
Jack's going to get smacked on the piggy potty.
I shall smack both your piggy bottoms if you don't behave.
That was how piggy bottoms became our nicknames. Warney, being bigger, insisted that he was Arch Piggy Bottom, or APB, while I was merely Small Piggy Bottom, or SPB. Years after, we would still refer to one another as APB and SPB. And it was Lizzie who started it all. Just as it was Lizzie who first introduced us to the land of fairies.
Into bed with you.
Then will you tell us a story?
We'll see.
Please, Lizzie, a story with fairies in it.
Bed is for sleep and too many fairies can keep you awake.
How can fairies keep you awake?
Why, I knew a boy once who grew paler and thinner and frailer altogether, sicklier than any boy I've ever seen.
What was wrong with him?
Well, that's what his mother wanted to know. So she asked him, "Whatever in the world's wrong with you, Jack?" That was his name. And do you know what he told her?
What?
He told her that every night, night after night, the fairies, being faithless creatures who must never be trusted, came to his room and carried him away, down, down, down and down, through the very floor and into the deepest depths of fairyland.
What happened to him there?
Well, you might be thinking he had the pleasantest of times, for didn't he dance the night away, spinning and twirling with the loveliest of all the lovely ladies in the fairy court? He ate the most delicious foods in all of fairydom. But
what?
He was never, not even for a moment, allowed to rest. So exhausted he was, night after night, that he became fearfully ill. And his poor mother, well, she was beside herself with worry.
What did she do?
What any caring mother would do. Sent for the priest to bless the boy, lest the fairies carry him off forever and ever.
Did it work?
Well, now, I'll tell you. No sooner had the priest blessed the boy than all the pain and worry vanished from his face and he fell into a deep, deep sleep. On the following morning, his mother asked how he was, and Jack said, "Last night I did not dance with the fairies." Well, on hearing this, his mother's hopes were raised. But then the boy went on. "Last night," says he, "I danced with the angels in a beautiful, peaceful garden."
Was it heaven?
Who can say? All I know is that Jack told his mother that he hadn't wanted to leave that garden, and that the angels had told him that before another day had passed, he would return. And so he did. Before the clock struck midnight, young Jack passed peacefully away with a smile of perfect happiness upon his lips. And as his little soul slipped through the golden gates into that beautiful garden, Jack's mother heard the tiny, unmistakable sound of...
What?
Of fairy laughter. Now, go to sleep like good little Christians, and always remember, God's help is nearer than the door.
I also vividly remember, from these early days, the terror of certain dreams.
No, no! Don't let it get me! Ah! Lizzie! Lizzie!
There! There now, child.
Make it go away, Lizzie, please!
Make what go away?
The lion chasing me. His big claws and teeth.
Oh, it's just a bad dream, Master Jack. Just a dream.
No, it was here. A big lion. I tried to run away.
I've never heard tell of there being any lions in Ulster. And I've heard of most things that are or might have been.
I know where there's a lion.
And where might that be?
On the door of Grandfather Hamilton's house.
The old brass doorknob at the rectory. Well, it'd take some pretty strong magic to bring that one to life, I reckon. Now, back to sleep with you.
But still, I wondered. Especially as a child, sitting in one of the pews immediately beneath the pulpit in Grandfather Hamilton's church, as the old man, a fearsome sight with his huge white side whiskers and glinting spectacles, fixed us with his searching gaze.
And what, my friends, is the emblem of our own Sid Mark but that of a lion? The lion, a creature which in Holy Scripture was likened to the tribe of Judah. The lion would also become a symbol of the supreme sovereignty of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, whom the writer of the book of Revelation calls the Lion of the Tribe.
The lion? Yes, what? Brethren, the doorknob?
Shh. Or Satan, the devil, the evil one, can also assume the form and likeness of the lion. And by so doing...
Go on, Jack. Push the doorknob. I dare you.
Which lion do you reckon it is? Jesus? Or the devil?
Don't be daft. Grandfather Hamilton wouldn't have the devil on his front door, would he?
Lions. I had a good many dreams about lions. But apart from that, I do not know where, years later, the lion Aslan came from, or why he came. But suddenly, he bounded in, and there he was. Huge, shaggy and bright, facing the rising sun. Its mouth was wide open, and the deepest, wildest voice was saying, "Narnia! Narnia! Narnia! Awake! Love! Think! Speak! Be walking trees, be talking beasts, be divine waters!" My preparation for being a children's writer began early. And in part, it began in Mullen's bookshop at Castle Junction, Belfast, where our father kept an account and where we often accompanied him. And while father talked Protestant politics with the man who ran it, Warnie and I wandered the book stacks, glancing into this volume, peeping into that, like characters exploring a corridor lined with many doors, all of which stood waiting to be opened. Doors marked Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, The Tale of Peter Rabbit, Gulliver's Travels, The Phoenix and the Carpet.
"Look, Jack, they've got the second Jungle Book.
This one's about knights in armour, battles and everything."
At Christmas, we were each allowed to choose a new book as a present.
"Well, boys, what's it to be? Any volume you like. Liberty Hall. Mr. Carson has recently acquired some interesting new volumes on Irish history."
"I'd like Plain Tales from the Hills, please."
"Not a work I've come across."
"Rudyard Kipling, Mr. Lewis."
"It's all about India."
"Not Ireland, then, but of all unlikely places, India."
"And you, Master Jack?"
"I'd like this one, please."
"Ah, E. Nesbitt's new book."
"And what is that about?"
"Magic."
"Tales of foreign lands and peculiar nonsense."
What delight I took in those magical stories. Very few of the books which I read as a child have ever faded from my memory.
"This is a tale about a tale. A tale that belonged to a little red squirrel and his name was Nutkin."
"Master Jack, your tea's on the table."
"I won't be long." "He had a brother called Twinkleberry and a great many cousins. They lived in a wood at the edge of a lake." "I opened the door and found that it led into a small passage, not much larger than a rat hole. She knelt down and looked along the passage into the loveliest garden you ever saw."
"Master Jack, it's way past your bedtime and gone."
"How she longed to get out of that dark hall and wander..."
"Jack, I'll not tell you again."
Our house had a garden, which then seemed large. But I didn't see it as something beautiful. In fact, I knew nothing of real beauty at all until on one of the endless rainy afternoons when we were confined to the nursery.
"What's that, Warnie?"
"It's a garden. You can help me finish it. It's still raining, so we can't go out to play in the garden. So I thought I'd make a garden to play with."
"It's beautiful, Warnie. How did you think of it?"
"Don't know. I just did. I took the lid off the biscuit tin, covered it with soil, put water on it. That's what's a bit swampy."
"We can make the small stuff into hills."
"Stick the stump there These twigs will look just like little tiny trees.
We'll make a forest.
I got daisies and buttercups. They're a bit big, but I couldn't find anything smaller. They'll make it look prettier.
This was the first beauty I ever knew. It made me aware of nature as something cool, dewy, fresh, exuberant. As long as I live, my imagination of paradise will retain something of my brother's toy garden.
What on earth do you think you're doing, Warren Hamilton Lewis, trailing all manner of dirt and mess across my clean floors?
It's our garden, Lizzie. Look.
Garden, indeed.
Isn't it the most beautiful garden in the whole world? Warney made it.
Oh, I might have known. Well, all the gardens I've ever come across, at least in civilised homes, not those inhabited by little savages, are to be found outside the house. And that's where this one's going. Outside.
No, Lizzie, please.
You can look at it through the window. If you raise your eyes a little further, you'll see the greater garden of the Lord God Almighty, who had the decency not to go traipsing it around indoors.
What garden?
Look over there. The hills. The Castlereagh Hills. Can't you two see any further than the end of your grubby noses?
The Green Hills, we called them. They seemed to us so far away as to be unattainable. Until, that is, we got our bikes.
Come on, Jack.
My legs are sore from pedaling. It's thirsty.
Keep up.
I'm trying to.
Pump faster.
Although these hills are not very high, the expanse seen from them is huge and various. The great breadth and width of the loch, mirroring the sky. The greyish-blue mass of the Antrim Mountains. The coast, twisting sharply to the north and out of sight, or curving away southward, green and humble. Rather like the country of my imagination, like Narnia. Narnia. Many coloured, with lawns and rocks and heather and different sorts of trees, and the river winding through it like a ribbon of quicksilver, and the mountains with, every now and then, a glimpse of the lands beyond, looking blue and far away to where, just before the eastern horizon, there was the gleam of the sea. The sea. Look out to sea from the hills above Belfast, and on a good day, you may even glimpse Scotland, phantom-like, on the horizon.
Nearly there. Race you to the top. Warnie, wait for me. Come on, Jack. You can do it.
And below, on the flat floor of the valley at your feet, a forest of factory chimneys, gantries and giant cranes, and rising out of the welter of mist, Belfast.
Read it. I'll beat you next time.
Jack, hear that?
What?
Noise, the city.
The whining and screeching of trams, the clatter of horse traffic on uneven streets, and dominating all else, the continual throb and stammer of the great shipyards.
Miss you back down.
Hey, that's not far. You're cheating.
Come on, Morley, keep up.
It was my seventh year that the first great change in my life took place. We moved house.
Let's explore. All right, then.
The new house was formerly known as Little Lee, but to a child it was anything but little.
Let's see what's down here.
Indeed, it seemed less like a house than a city.
More stairs?
Come on.
I am the product of long corridors, empty, sunlit rooms, upstairs indoor silences, distant noises of gurgling cisterns and pipes, and wind under the tiles.
It's really dark up here.
It's the attic, that's why. We're under the roof.
It's just like a cave.
Perfect.
This must be our room. I mean, just us. No one else.
We can pull things out of all these packing cases. There's two broken chairs here. And look, a trunk. Wonder what's inside.
Locked. Probably pirate treasure or something.
We'll have to find a way to open it before the pirates come back.
We'll have to stay up here and guard it.
We can have picnics up here and sandwiches and buns and chocolate bars.
And we can use these empty bottles to put candles in. And it would really be like a pirate cave.
Jack! Warnie!
Better go down. Warnie, this is our secret, isn't it?
Yes, no one should find out.
Where are you, boys? Didn't you hear your mother?
It was at Little Lee that I became aware for the first time of how many books my parents owned.
Albert, why do you have to buy every book you think you might one day want to read and then never, ever get rid of any?
Well, it seems that all these books here, according to the inscription, are owned by Florence Hamilton.
Well, be that as it may, we will never find room for them all.
Of course we will. In the bookcase along here and over here, and the shelves in that far corner.
Endless books. Books in the study, books in the drawing room, books in the cloakroom, books too deep in the great bookcase on the landing, books in the bedroom. There were books, readable and unreadable, books suitable for a child, and books most emphatically not. Nothing was forbidden me.
Can I read these, Pavi?
The Great Chaucer. Balzac. Well, why not? Why not? Yes, you can.
Thank you.
No thanks required, my boy. This is Liberty Hall, remember? Liberty Hall.
In the seemingly endless rainy afternoons, I took volume after volume from the shelves. I had always the same certainty of finding a book that was new to me, as a man who walks into a field has of finding a new blade of grass. Most of them were read in our attic room, the walls of which we decorated with pictures, of our own making or cut from brightly coloured Christmas numbers of magazines. There we could spend hours together, providing we could rustle up adequate provisions.
You know fine well it is, Master Warnie, which is why you two have come snooping around my kitchen.
We've come to help you, Lizzie.
Help? Come to help yourselves to my pies, more like.
Mm-mm. They smell really good.
Good. And the answer's no.
Ow! Still hot, too.
Get your grubby little hands off those.
Oh, just a couple, Lizzie. Please!
Not before tea time. What would your mother say if she caught you scoffing pies straight after breakfast?
Just who? Here, catch, Warnie.
Hey, you come back here right now. Won't we tie the two of you when I get my hands on you?
In our attic, we created an imaginary kingdom which we called Animal Land.
I think it should be an island shaped like this, like a dagger, and with another smaller island over here called Fishland.
It could be off the coast of somewhere, like India. You could just put a bit of it in there, at the edge of the map. That's it.
We ought to say how big it is. Something like, I don't know, 110,600 square miles. It'll be divided into different areas.
We could call them provinces.
Yes, provinces. I've already decided what one part's going to be. Mouseland. And there could be Rabbitland, Squirrelland, even Ratland.
Yes, and Foxland. There should be a Wolfland and a Bearland. What other animals?
Horseland, Pigland.
What about Birdland?
I'll put down Birdland too.
And Insectland, how many's that?
With Fishland, 12.
13 would be better.
All right then, we'll call the 13th province the land of typical animals. And we'll have to think up names for all the mountains and rivers and decide where the railway is and what the capital city is going to be.
That ought to be in Mouseland, really, because they thought of Mouseland first. That's where we'll have the Parliament buildings. And we could call it Murray.
Why Murray?
Sounds a bit like mouse and furry. And I want to call the river the Jemima, so it'd probably be known as Murray on the Jemima. And the most important character would be Sir Peter Mouse, and he can have all sorts of adventures.
Thus my first stories were written combining my two chief literary pleasures, dressed animals and knights in armour. As a result, I wrote about chivalrous mice who rode out to kill not giants, but cats.
Chapter 6, The Relief of Murray. We had been listening to Sir Peter Mouse, the famous and illustrious knight, all afternoon. But now we went out into the grounds of Pitt Castle to enjoy ye fine summer winds. Now, quoth I to Sir Peter, wilt go a-hawking on the banks of Jemima, my lord?
When do we get to battle?
In a minute. That's what's called setting the scene. But Sir Peter Mouse said, nay, more serious work is there than that. The cats have besieged the city of Murray, and it is likely to fall into the hands if we do not send help very soon. I myself will lead the expedition. Hurrah!
That's more like it!
Next morning, after an early breakfast, we started in the direction of Murray. It was surrounded completely by the enemy's tents. We scurried among these rows of guns and armed men.
Men?
Cats, I mean, cats. In the early morning, we covered our shining armour with dark cloaks and crept up behind the cat sentries and killed them. Then we rushed in and set fire to the hostile tents. The confusion was dreadful. Everywhere the sullen thunder of guns.
That's good. Sullen thunder. I like that.
The groans of the wounded, the crackle of the fires, and the wild shouts of Sir Peter Mouse forever. When all of a sudden the long fierce strain was over, the cats had fled, the siege was raised.
It's very exciting, Jack, but I thought Sir Peter Mouse was going to get killed.
He is in the next chapter, when he leads the heroic mice attack on Catland. It's a pity, though, he has to die, as I really liked Sir Peter.
Let's work out the attack plan on the map.
Sir Peter Mouse. He was indeed slain, but he was to live again in Narnia as Reepy Cheep, that sleek little bright-eyed talking mouse who wore a rapier at his side, a red feather stuck in a circlet of gold on his head, and who twirled his long whiskers as if they were a moustache.
And from Topsy on the coast, they could then make their way along the Jemima estuary to Murray. It stopped raining.
Let's go out.
Or, to use Father's words, out of doors. From the front doorsteps, there was a view of wide fields running down to Belfast Loch, and across it to the long mountain line of the Antrim shore. The view, we called it. Oh, how I remember the interminable summer sunsets behind the blue ridges and the rooks flying home. It was in these surroundings that the blows of change began to fall. First, my brother was packed off to England and life in boarding school.
I've packed your trunk, Master Warney, and I know everything that's in it. So don't you go losing any of your socks and handkerchiefs and then be telling me that you never have them.
No, Lizzie.
And you'll be good. And do as you're told by anyone who's in charge of telling you what to do. Or we'll all know all about it soon enough, that's for sure.
Yes, Lizzie.
And remember, there was never a door shut, but there was another opened. Now, say goodbye to your brother and hurry up and get in the carriage. Your parents haven't got all day to wait around for you.
Bye, Jack. Bye, Warney. See you in the holidays.
Yes.
Come along now, Warney.
If you don't hurry, you're going to miss the ferry.
Up you get.
Don't forget Craig! I'll send you all the weekly news from Animal Land.
Then came that other parting. How to describe that great loss which befell our family.
Hello, Lizzie.
Shh! Not so much noise, Master Jack.
What's wrong?
Now listen to me. You must be nice and quiet in the house. Your mother, poor lamb, is not very well.
What's wrong with her?
Difficult to say.
What can be done, Doctor?
We can deal with the pain, of course. Possibly an operation. Maybe with complete rest.
Come on upstairs, Jack.
But listen.
Shh.
What are the chances?
Difficult to say. Very difficult.
But the quieter she is kept, more chances she stands.
There were doors shutting and opening, comings and goings all over the house. Strangers in her room. It seemed to last for hours. Then my father came to my room.
Jack.
What, Pappy, what?
Your mother. Jack. It's terrible news. You must be brave, Jack. We must all be brave.
What's wrong with Mummy?
She's not well, son. She's sick. Very sick. Pray for your mother, Jack. Please, please pray, will you?
Yes. O Lord, look down from heaven, the old visit, and relieve this thy servant.
But it was cancer. Warnie was called home from school. We lost her as she was gradually withdrawn from our life into the hands of nurses and delirium and morphia. My brother and I came to rely more and more exclusively on each other for all that made life bearable, to have confidence only in each other. Daily we grew closer together, two frightened urchins huddled for warmth in a bleak world. Our mother's illness took the usual course.
The operation, was it successful?
Impossible to predict. Simply too early to be sure. Convalescence for a while. Then we'll see. Yes? Wait and see.
Yes. Yes, of course.
If only there was something we could have done.
Master Jack, what are you doing out here on the landing?
Nothing.
Doing nothing? Must be one of the busiest pastimes known to boys.
What have you got there, Lizzie?
Grapes for your poor mother.
Will they make her better?
Oh, Master Jack, your mammy is very, very weak. I don't think grapes will cure her. She'd need the fruit of youth to help her now. Help her fight this terrible illness.
Where can we get the fruit of youth? Can I go there and get what she needs to make her better?
Master Jack, it's not in this world, I fear. Come on. We'll go in and see your mammy together.
If only life were like the storybooks, all things would be possible. The little boy would go softly into his mother's room, and there she'd lay, as he had seen her lie so many other times, propped up on the pillows, with a thin, pale face that would make you cry to look at it. He'd take the apple of life out of his pocket, and the brightness of the apple would throw strange lights on the ceiling. Nothing else would be worth looking at. You wouldn't be able to look at anything else. And the smell of the apple of youth would be as if there was a window in the room that opened on heaven. "Oh, darling," she'd say, "how lovely." And the boy would reply, "You will eat it, won't you? Please?" The mother would smile. "I don't know what the doctor would say, but really, I almost feel as if I could." And the boy would peel the apple and cut it up and give it to his mother piece by piece. And no sooner would she have finished it than she'd smile and her head would sink back on the pillow in sleep, a real, natural, gentle sleep, without any nasty drugs. To the little boy, it would seem as if her face looked a little different. He'd bend down and kiss her very softly and then steal out of the room with a beating heart. That is how it would have been in a storybook. But for my mother, no one could help her. There was only a return of the disease, increasing pain, and death.
We must open the windows, turn the mirrors to the wall, and stop the clocks.
We were taken into the bedroom where our mother lay dead.
Come along, the pair of you. You must see her.
To see her, in reality, as I at once knew, was to see it.
See how peaceful she looks. Bless the dear soul.
Grief was overwhelmed in terror.
How beautiful she is. Now she's free of pain.
To this day, I do not know what they mean when they call dead bodies beautiful. The ugliest man alive is an angel of beauty compared with the loveliest of the dead.
For as much as it hath pleased Almighty God of his great mercy to take unto himself the soul of our sister Florence Augusta, here departed, earth to earth, ashes to ashes,
oh, let's see,
dust to dust.
Here.
Insurance certain hope of the resurrection.
No one ever told me that grief felt so like fear. The same fluttering in the stomach, the same restlessness, the yawning. I kept swallowing. With my mother's death, all settled happiness, all that was tranquil and reliable, disappeared from my life.
Warnie, are you asleep?
No. What do you want?
Nothing.
Just I know you're there. Yes, I'm here.
Night.
Night.
Everything that had made the house a home had failed us. There was to be much fun, many pleasures, many stabs of joy, but no more of the old security. It was sea and islands now. The great continent had sunk like Atlantis.
But why do we have to go to school in England?
To learn all those things you need to learn. Do you want to grow up with folks saying that your feeding was better than your education? Besides, it hasn't done Warnie any harm, has it?
I don't want to go back there. See?
What sort of an example is that to set your brother? You should be ashamed of yourself. I don't know what your poor mother would have said. You can't expect your father to be coping with you too when he has his own sorrow to contend with. And as for me, well, I'm getting far too old for all your shenanigans.
Lizzie!
Don't you want us here anymore?
Come along. For your sweet mother's sake. You must both be very brave and very grown up. Then old Lizzie can be proud of you both.
Clop, 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 clop. The four-wheeler rattled over the uneven stones of the Belfast streets through the damp twilight of a September evening. My father, my brother and I, on our way to the quay and the old Fleetwood ferry.
My boys, this is where we part. The old order changeth, as Tennyson observed. How we are to go on without your dear mother, I do not know, but try we must. However hopeless it may be. Warnie, Jack, I ask only that you be a credit to her. Remember her with love, for she will be watching over you from heaven. As she watched over you when she was amongst us, and when for so short a time we were all together.
He was deeply moved. I was mainly embarrassed and self-conscious.
Godspeed, my boys.
Goodbye.
I saw the port and starboard lights reflected on the oily water. There was a rattle of winches, the warm smell from the engine room skylight. We cast off. The black space widened between us and the quay.
Feel the engine throbbing down below, Jack.
Soon, we were dropping down the loch.
Lick your lips, Jack. Taste the salt.
The cluster of lights astern, receding from us, was everything I had ever known.
Jack. Goodbye.
A new and very different life was beginning. There were the holidays back home, visits to friends, and many years later, an unexpected honeymoon among the hills and meandering lanes of Ulster with a woman whom I dearly loved, but who, like my mother, was cruelly lost to me. We returned, she and I, from that visit, as I have invariably returned from visiting my homeland, drunk with blue mountains, yellow beaches, dark fuchsia, breaking waves, and the heather just beginning to bloom. Ulster. It's there, in my very being, blood and bone. It's there in my stories, in Narnia, in the realm beyond the wardrobe.
Presently, instead of crunching snow under her feet, Lucy felt the wooden boards, and all at once she found herself jumping out of the wardrobe into the same empty room from which the whole adventure had started. She shut the wardrobe door tightly behind her and looked around. She could hear the voices of the others in the passage. "I'm here," she shouted. "I'm here."
"I've come back. I'm all right."
That's the end of the chapter.
And time you were settling down for the night.
Mr. Jack, someday will I go to Narnia? I mean, go and meet Aslan and Mr. Tumnusson and everybody.
Well, you never know.
Can I get there through the wardrobe?
Well, you know what the professor in my book tells the children about Narnia? No one ever gets there by the same route. The wardrobe only worked the once.
Are there other ways?
Of course. As long as you believe, anything is possible. Good night, Penny.
Night, night.
C.S. Lewis died on the 22nd of November, 1963. In 1998, during the centenary celebrations of C.S. Lewis's birth, Belfast schoolchildren were invited to imagine that they could write a letter to one of their favourite authors, who many were surprised to discover was born in the same city as themselves.
Dear Mr. Lewis, I am Sarah, and I am 11 years old. I go to Mersey Street Primary in East Belfast, around the corner from where you used to live.
My name is Alana. I know that your granddad worked in the shipyard. My granddad Billy works in the shipyard.
My name is Angela. Our teacher read us a bit out of your brother Warney's memoirs. He describes the Castlereagh Hills as strange, distant, and unattainable. Is that where you got the idea for Narnia?
My name is Scott. I've read your books and would like to ask you if Caer Paravel is really Belfast Castle.
One day I will drop by your house and maybe even see a little fawn carrying an umbrella.
There isn't much magic in East Belfast, but when children read your stories, they come into a magical world.
That was the Northern Irish man in C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis was played by Geoffrey Palmer, the young C.S. Lewis by Dario Angeloni. Warney was played by Jack Logue, Lizzie was Doreen Keogh, and the grandfather was James Ellis. The father was played by Stuart Graham, the mother by Laura Hughes, the doctor by John Hewitt, Penny by Hannah R. Gordon, and the children were Sarah Gordon, Cora McGee, and Patrick Gledhill. The Northern Irishman and C.S. Lewis was written by Brian Sibley and directed in Belfast by Gemma McMullen.